It's Tuesday, March 28th, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Lubbock, Texas. Good evening and welcome to another podcast rebroadcast of a conversation from the Florida Educational Technology Conference last week in Orlando, Florida. This time I have a recorded discussion that I had with one of the representatives from the Library of Congress. And I am, as you may know from listening to my podcast or reading my blog, a real big history fan. In fact, I just love to study history. I love to read about history. My wife and I have really been enjoying the Netflix DVD service, in large part because of the access that we have to just tremendous specials from Nova and PBS and all kinds of other sources. But when I saw the Library of Congress booth at the Florida Educational Technology Conference, I was immediately excited to go up and learn a little bit more, because I had heard and visited online, but heard from some other people about some of the resources from the library, and I wanted to have an opportunity not only to learn myself, but also share with others what some of those resources are and what they can do, and also to provide an opportunity for a librarian from the Library of Congress to talk about and address the importance of library research and how not everything is digital. We seem to live in a day where students maybe just do their research if they have access to the internet on the internet. But there certainly are tremendous benefits to doing library research, but depending on what we're doing. But, you know, the case of genealogy is one example. So, anyway, I hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you have any comments or questions, I would welcome your feedback, and you can comment here on the blog post, or you can certainly email me by visiting my personal website at www.wesfryer.com and just clicking the contact link there on the top. Well, I'm here with Cheryl at the Florida Educational Technology Conference in the Library of Congress booth, and I was just wondering if you'd tell us a little bit about the way that the Library of Congress is viewing students and multimedia projects, and why teachers should be aware of the resources that are here in the Library of Congress website.
Sure, Wesley. The Library of Congress has an archive, a vast archive, and has been working for about 10 years to digitize portions of it, to make it accessible to students and certainly adults as well who can't physically come to Washington, D.C. to view them, to study them, to interact with them, to learn about the history of the United States of America. We have digitized entire books. We have about, I think, American Memory, which is a large collection of collections on a variety of topics ranging from technology historically, to war, to women's history. We have digitized books, we have digitized historical magazines and newspapers. For example, we have the entire archive of the World War I edition of Stars and Stripes online. And you can leaf through that, you can zoom in and read the text, you can copy it, paste it into your presentation, reference it, if you will, in your papers. There are also images, ranging from the early images. Matthew Brady was one of the early commercial photographers, and he photographed the Civil War, which was the first war to be photographed. Now, it's worth reading the special presentations on that one, because photographer ethics were new at that point, and he was not above rearranging the dead, for example, to get the effect he wanted. So does the picture really tell the true story?
Wow. Interesting. Even then, it might not have.
The photographer was not above manipulating. We have maps that are scanned with a compression technology that allow a user to zoom in and pull up a rich level of detail. And unlike current maps, which are frequently just fairly prosaic portrayals of getting from here to there and what kind of roads you have, old maps added more decoration, so you can pull up and see that. you can also use those maps to trace the evolution of a particular town. We have bird's eye view maps, which are artists' drawings and actually include drawings of individual buildings. And you can use using the Zoom technology, you can see more detail than you can often see if you physically have the paper map in front of you. We have audio files ranging from interviews with former slaves. Those are, you think about
just
the
transcriptions
amount,
or the actual audio?
No, actual audio files. And you think about it, those were old, old people because the technology was just not available early in their lives. So you hear their actual voices. And those do come with transcriptions because of the age of them and the newness of the technology at the time, the recordings are kind of scratchy. So those do come with transcripts. We have interviews with folks from around the country immediately after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, just getting their reactions the day after the bombing and then about 3 months later in the same location. What I think of as a parallel collection to that is they did the same kind of interviewing immediately after the September 11th bombing. We have Edison's early motion pictures. So we're not just a print archive. There's a rich resource there. With the older materials, like Edison's films, for example, Brady's photographs, there's no copyright restriction on that kind of stuff. That's not true of all of the materials. Every collection in American Memory comes with a copyright statement, and it's worth reviewing those copyright statements before you do anything that would be outside the bounds of fair use for the item.
Right. Well, as more students are involved in for instance, podcasting, like we're doing here, is there a way that things are flagged where you can readily see what might be sort of audio content that would be copyright friendly for podcasting or for them, you know, taking an excerpt but then actually sharing it out? Because I know fair use has changed if you're going to share it on the internet. If you're going to do things in your classroom, it's very different than if you're sharing it on the internet.
Exactly. And that's a complicated question, and I'm going to take it as a two-part question. You said, is there a way to find audio? And in American Memory, you can click a browse button that allows you to browse collections that have audio components. So that would be the first part of finding the audio. The second part is, of course, much more complicated. And they're not tagged at the item level. Most of the collections come with a statement, something to the effect of, to the best of the Library of Congress's knowledge, these are not restricted. However, it's up to the user to establish that. The Library of Congress doesn't actually own the rights to most of this, so we can't grant permission to use.
Oh, wow.
That said, when you're working with something that's historically old, anything prior to the 1920s, is fairly safe to guess is in the public domain.
Right.
Anything after that, you really want to take a close look at, and there's not an easy answer to that.
Well, I know the Creative Commons is one place where people are searching for things that are explicitly shared with the right to remix or the right to, you know, use for non-commercial purposes and stuff like that. So I guess right now people just need to read the fine print and be able to find out what they can do with it and also look at the date.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's good advice.
Okay, good. Well, what other kinds of media, as far as the documents that we have historically, those belong to the people, right? So when we're talking about the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution or other kinds of things that would be, say, part of the National Archives, do you all have those as well in the Library of Congress, or do people go to the National Archives for that?
Both. We have some of that kind of stuff. For example, we have an early draft of the Declaration of Independence with the scribbles and scratchings and marginal comments and, editing changes. We have that, and that's digitized in our American Treasures exhibition. Because we do have, I've talked a lot about American Memory. In addition to American Memory, there's a lot of other material. For example, we have a whole section of exhibitions. We do physical exhibitions at the library. Those rotate about every 4 to 6 months. it's not necessarily convenient to come to the Library of Congress to see the exhibition. So we also digitize at least those portions that are not restricted by copyright. We have to play by copyright rules ourselves. We digitize the collections, and those are archived on the website, and those don't go away.
Can you talk a little bit about archival and digital archival? I've sort of started to think that today for a student, we're almost in an era where it has to be digital to be relevant, because I love libraries and I love books, but when we look at what kids are doing as they're researching, increasingly they're going to the web and they're using those kind of tools. So the work that you're doing is so important as far as archiving and digitizing. What can you talk a little bit about the process that they do? I mean, people have seen scanners and things like that. I mean, are you just scanning documents? Or I would think it's more sophisticated than that.
That is completely out of my area of expertise. So rather than tell the not truth, I'll just say I'm not involved in that. What I do is try to develop ways for teachers and students, therefore, to work with the content that we have.
Well, how much of a part of the mission of the library is the whole digital realm, though, in terms of the website?
It's very important right now because as you say, these documents belong to the people. It is the Library of the Congress of the United States, and digitizing makes it widely accessible. You asked about some of the archival questions. I do know that before an item is scanned, there's a conservation review to make sure that the item can stand up to the actual process, because there's a certain amount of wear and tear, and some items cannot take that. They would deteriorate.
Right. Well, do you work in Washington in the library?
I do.
Can you talk a little bit about the value of going to the library? Because, you know, that's something I've been listening to podcasts about, for instance, genealogical research.
Sure.
And the researcher has said, don't think that, it's all on the web. There's so much in the library. So can you speak a little bit to the value of coming to the library and what kinds of research that you'll be able to do there that you just can't do online today?
Well, and you've really answered that in your question. We've digitized 10.5 million items. There are, I'm not good with numbers, so that's probably less than 10% of the library's holdings. I'm sure it's considerably less than 10%, but I'm not good with numbers. The reading rooms at the Library of Congress are available to anybody above high school age, so anybody over the age of 18 who comes and goes through a fairly simple and painless registration process to get a library card can use the reading room. Now, if a digital facsimile will serve your research purposes, you'll be directed to that, because it does conserve and preserve the fragile resources. But if you can demonstrate a resource need to see the original, you will be served that in most cases. But it's not, the research rooms are not for idle souvenir hunting and tourist thrill seeking, but for any kind of scholarship, and personal scholarship certainly fits in that. So you mentioned genealogy. If you're seeking your family's genealogy, the genealogy reading room would be a great place to come. And a relatively limited number of those resources have been digitized. Items that get digitized are often those which would be in highest demand or of most broad interest. On the other hand, coming to the library is just, it's a really amazing building. Well, it's three buildings. The amazing one that has the most public space is the Jefferson Building, which was built at the end of the 19th century and is very beautiful. And that's where most of the exhibitions are housed.
Right. Well, would teachers that are interested in utilizing the library need any kind of virtual library card, or is there, and then I guess another question is there a submission process in certain projects where oral histories, for instance, are being submitted from people that the library is soliciting? How much of it is the library, how much of an opportunity, I guess, is there now for teachers and students to be sort of oral history archivists or sort of contribute to oral history or to the history of our country through the Library of Congress? Are there initiatives like that?
The big one that's ongoing is the Veterans History Project. And we certainly encourage, especially high school level students, to submit those histories. There aren't any other initiatives right now for collecting anything else, which is not to say that it's not important to do that. It's terrifically important to take those oral histories and document this time and this place and real everyday Americans' experiences. Even though the Library of Congress doesn't currently have the facilities to take those, you could certainly start a local history archive in your school or working with your local library. Those kinds of initiatives, I think, are really important.
Let me ask you a card catalog question. You know, kids today sometimes haven't ever heard of a card catalog. I mean, they haven't seen it.
Right.
How much of the indexing that the Library of Congress has presently is electronic, and I'm just interested, kind of personally, how has the card catalog transitioned to digital, and how much of it, are there still card catalogs in the library?
There are some card catalogs, just because it takes a long time to enter the data and get it moved over. That said, there, and the other issue with digital is the stability of digital records. So I think that, and I'm not directly involved in this, so this is my caveat. I'm not speaking as anything like an expert on this. I think there's some ongoing conversation about what needs to be done with that question. The value of the digital catalog, of course, is it's accessible from any place.
Right.
And that's certainly with value. But there are still a few paper card catalogs. I think most of the ones that we're producing now are primarily digital.
So if somebody's going to come to the reading room and do some genealogical research or some other kind of scholarly research, they're probably going to be using a computer terminal in order to search archives, and then
right.
possibly, if it's not digitized, look at some kind of original artifact.
Exactly.
Is it the library running out of space?
Well, we've been expanding, for sure. We have the three buildings on Capitol Hill. We also have storage off-site, but not far away. And we're in the process of actually moving the stuff, I guess.
The actual analog stuff.
The analog stuff from the motion picture division, because that's bulky stuff.
Right.
That's moving out to Culpeper, Virginia, which is a couple of hours outside of D.C. Part of that is because it's bulky, and part of that is because some of the early films were done on nitrate stock, which is enormously flammable. Will burn underwater.
Oh my God.
And we cannot have that on Capitol Hill.
Oh wow.
That's been stored at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. So we're moving it to Culpeper into bunkers to have it a little more accessible and get those collections in one place. The actual reference room is not moving out of the library on Capitol Hill, and they anticipate trucks going back pretty regularly to move that. So running out of space, not yet, but looking creatively for new places.
Okay. Well, anything else you'd like to share? This is a podcast for educators interested in digital resources and 21st century learning, and just, you know, it's a general podcast for folks interested in resources. Any other things you'd like to share with that kind of an audience?
Just a note that in addition to the artifacts themselves and the digital facsimiles of those artifacts, we do have resources packaging those, if you will, into lesson plans and activities so that teachers certainly can do their own research and build their own lessons from scratch, but in a busy teacher's schedule, we have some prepackaged things that they can use whole or take parts of. We also do video conference staff development.
Oh, wow.
To help teachers learn how to use the website
and
how to
great.
Use the material.
Is there a cost for that for the school?
The only cost would be they need to have the equipment, and any connection fees we'd ask them to absorb.
Right, right.
So there is no fee for the library employees' time for presentations, that sort of thing.
And is that something that's usually heavily scheduled and that you need to do months in advance? Is it hard to get in to do that kind of thing? Or?
I don't think so. I think we're pretty good about being able to work with teachers' schedules. It does require maybe a little bit of flexibility. I'm not directly involved in that, so I can't speak real specifically to that.
So that's a great outreach opportunity because
it
then
is.
They're not looking just at the website, but a person that's helping explain, and they don't have to have a local expert.
And not only that, but for example, you mentioned gathering oral history. Funny you should say that, Wesley, because we have a video conference on gathering oral history. And it's not just somebody from the library telling teachers. It's an actual workshop, an actual sort of teaching opportunity where the participants have activities that they do.
So that would be a great way for you. I'm at a university. And that would be a great way for the university to get involved as far as teachers. The university had those video conferencing resources or the
Absolutely.
Time to set that stuff
and,
up. That would be a great professional development opportunity.
It's very exciting if you have an education department to allow the Library of Congress to reach the pre-service teachers and get them started early in their teaching careers, making use of these primary source resources.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, definitely the best way to experience history is through the primary sources and through the voices, and so appreciate your work and just all the work that, you know, folks are doing to share this stuff. And it's good to talk about the value of going to the library, but it's also real exciting to hear about the digitization and the access, because Not everybody can come
to D.C. as often as they would like to. And even if they could come, we can't let second graders into the reading rooms. But you can certainly pull up a map and have them study that, for example, listen to an audio file.
Well, having a second grader who played Thomas Jefferson in his little school play this year, I think the idea of going back and pulling up that Declaration of Independence with, you know, notes on the side, I mean, that's a priceless opportunity that he wouldn't have otherwise.
Well, and not only that, certainly those important, you know, well-known landmark documents and well-known figures of history, but also the things that make them human. For example, Thomas Jefferson drew a design for a macaroni machine. He had traveled in Europe and was quite taken with macaroni. And you can see that drawing, which brings out some of the human side of him. We have a love letter that George Washington wrote when he was a late adolescent, 16, 17, 18 years old. And that just gives a whole different appearance to the stern founding father, first president of the United States.
These were human beings.
These were human beings.
Fathers and husbands and
exactly.
Dads.
And we have a lot of oral histories and letters and diaries and journals. Some people that you'll never read about in a textbook as anything other than an aggregate group, such as People Settled the Prairie.
Uh-huh.
So you can get an insight into the individual experiences.
And how about female voices and the experience of founding mothers? I know my wife has been reading Founding Mothers, and there's a lot of literature now that's being published.
There's quite a bit on women's suffrage and other aspects of women's history. Sometimes you have to dig a little for those.
Right.
But they're certainly there.
Right. Right. Well, thanks so much for taking
the
time.
Absolutely.